From early mask requirements to increased health services, Native American communities in the Northwoods took extra steps to keep people safe.
It was a lot of work. We made a lot of sacrifices over the last year. However, I believe it was well worth it.
We're talking with local tribal communities about what steps they took and why.
COVID-19 forced theaters across the country to close their curtains for the 2020 season.
This would have been their 57th season, and they have never gone dark before from live performances.
How local theaters are getting creative to continue performing amid a pandemic.
The U.S. now has 3 approved COVID-19 vaccines, and Wisconsin is now averaging more than 200,000 vaccinations a week.
These vaccines are medical marvels.
We're talking with a medical expert about the vaccines and what they mean for the end of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thanks for joining us for this WXPR special report. Heading into 2020, the nation planned to give Wisconsin plenty of political attention. It promised to be one of the most contested swing states in the presidential race. But the pandemic put Wisconsin politics on display for an additional reason. Partisan tensions in Madison grew even deeper as Republican lawmakers fought Democratic Governor Tony Evers' COVID management plans at seemingly every turn. Ben Meyer spoke to J.R. Ross, the longtime editor at wispolitics.com, about a state government Ross now calls dysfunctional.
Just 2 weeks after Governor Evers issued his Safer at Home order, more than 400,000 people went to the polls to vote in person in Wisconsin's April election. No other state dared to hold in-person voting out of health and safety concerns. Evers had tried calling a special legislative session, tried an executive order, tried appealing to the Supreme Court to stop or postpone the election, but Republicans insisted it must go forward. The partisan divide over COVID-19 would grow ever deeper in Wisconsin during the coming year, but J.R. Ross, the editor at wispolitics.com, told me the fight over holding that election set the tone for what was to come.
We were like the only game in town where people are going to go to the polls, period, as this pandemic was taking hold. And that's when you saw Evers really try to pull out all the stops to delay the election. And it was like just a whiplash of court decision, action, court decision, court decision. Election was on.
I seem to remember the coverage from outside Wisconsin covering Wisconsin's election on April 7th. During a pandemic as kind of having this tinge of Wisconsin is crazy right now for having an in-person vote seemed to be a bit of the national consensus. Is that what you remember as well?
Yes. And the other lasting image of the April 6th primary was Assembly Speaker Robin Voss at a polling site in his home district around Burlington in southeastern Wisconsin saying it's safe to vote in person while he's wearing all this PPE garb, and people going, that's not really an image that suggests it's safe to be there on purpose if you're wearing all this stuff. It's an image that lasted for a long time. And there are people in Madison who believe that that experience kind of shaped Voss's view of how to approach COVID-19 for the rest of the year.
It's a popular view that on the state government level that Wisconsin is this hyper-polarized state, this hyper-partisan state between a Democratic governor and a Republican-controlled legislature. My question is, how in your view, has this year of COVID affected that? Has polarization intensified even more, or does it have a different look and feel, or is it similar to where we were a year ago?
Look, we all know alcohol doesn't change your personality, it amplifies your personality. In the same vein, a crisis doesn't change who you are, it amplifies who you are. And in this Capitol, it is basically not functioning at this point. There is a broken relationship between Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Republican lawmakers. Part of it is split government, but in a functioning capital, you would have people on both sides. And I'm trying to stress this. It's not just like group A is blamed or group B is blamed. There's blame to go around. In a functioning capital, you would find ways to get things done in spite of your differences and look for common ground. That is not happening in the Capitol right now.
I know that each week in the Wispolitics report, there's a stock report, right? Rising, falling, staying steady. If you were to extrapolate that over the past year, who are the figures that come to your mind most prominently as rising or falling in the past year in Wisconsin politics?
I mean, the governor's people think he did a great job, you know, dealing with COVID-19. Republicans don't. That's pretty universal. Robin Voss didn't win many Democratic fans in how he handled COVID-19 in 2020. It's the way it is. We were dysfunctional in 2020. And it's not getting any better right now through the early parts of 2021. And I don't know if there's going to be somebody who is the big enough person to step in and say, okay, I know you've insulted me X thousand times, but I'm going to be the bigger person and say, let's get this done.
What are you most interested to see about how things develop in year two of Wisconsin politics during COVID? What are you keeping your eye on most?
So we did see a little sprout of an olive branch with a revised unemployment insurance bill that passed both houses overwhelmingly and the governor signed. But it's probably a sign when getting a bill done by a large margin is actually noteworthy in the Capitol, because it's so rare that it happens right now. There are a lot of fights on the horizon. I'm just trying to figure out where can they actually agree and get things done, rather than staying in their corners and fighting about things that are maybe markers in 2022.
J.R. Ross, the editor at wispolitics.com, also told me he's confident President Trump's handling of the pandemic and the associated slide in the economy cost him Wisconsin last year. President Biden beat Trump by 21,000 votes in the state.
While the COVID-19 pandemic did become a point of political contention, local tribes did their best to take the politics out of it and focus on the science to keep communities safe. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Native Americans have experienced 1.5 times greater deaths from COVID-19 compared to Wisconsin's white residents. Katie Thorson spoke with some tribal communities in our region about their response to the pandemic.
Some changes within the Sakagan Chippewa community in Mole Lake are more obvious than others. To get into the recently reopened casino, you have to get your temperature taken and answer some screening questions.
Welcome. Your temperature is normal.
A giant marquee in town encourages people to get a COVID-19 test at the SCC Health Clinic if they need it. Other changes, like newly installed fiber optic cables for better broadband, can't be seen on the surface. But all the changes are a direct result of the COVID-19 pandemic.
It was a lot of work. We made a lot of sacrifices over the last year. However, I believe it was well worth it.
Jake Gooden is a public information officer and on the SCC's incident command team that was created a year ago to lead the tribe's response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
We were monitoring the situation, you know, all the way from the beginning.
Gooden says the motivation for all their actions was to keep the community safe for both tribal and non-tribal members.
You know, we all live here together, so we got to take care of each other.
SCC shut down its casino, hotel, and convenience store when the statewide order went into effect last March. The casino and hotel stayed closed long after the order was lifted.
We didn't want to be a facilitator of spreading this virus.
Restrictions remained fairly loose during the summer, but as Labor Day weekend drew near, the tribe became concerned. Students would be heading back to school, tourists would be coming up for one last big weekend, and nearby Crandon was hosting off-road races that drew in thousands of people.
We basically called it the perfect storm, you know.
Gooden told me SCC essentially locked down the community for months, limiting access to certain areas and only allowing those who lived in Mole Lake in the convenience store and only after temperature checks.
We were concerned about the well-being of the small tribal community that we have here, and also the fact that about a third of them are elderly.
Those concerns turned out to be valid as Forest County, like the entire state, saw COVID-19 cases skyrocket after Labor Day. To the north, just across the border in the Upper Peninsula, Lac-Vieux d'Azur took a similar approach. A team closely monitored the situation. Tribal Chairman James William Jr. says to this day they're constantly changing and adjusting as need be.
Our crew here, our team, worked very hard to make sure that we did what we had to do to keep people safe and and keep them working. I guess that was the biggest part.
Whenever cases started going up, new restrictions would go into place until they started going down again. Lakvita's Zaire Health Clinic Director Sadie Valier says that did the job.
You know, after a few weeks, everybody was out of isolation and quarantine, and we were able to go back to following the CDC guidelines again.
Though what Williams is most proud of is the tribe's support in the schools. At the start of the last school year, WLUC-TV reported Lakvita Zaire donated a fund of up to $600,000 to the Watersmeet School District. The money the tribe got from the CARES Act went to technology upgrades for the district so it could support virtual learning, including each student getting their own Chromebook.
But if we don't make it easier for them because of COVID and making it easier for virtual learning, getting them set up with the right equipment, things like that, it's only going to be worse. And it has gotten worse. I mean, we have some kids that are failing, unfortunately, because they just don't grasp, the virtual things.
The tribe also worked with the district and local Boys and Girls Club to make sure kids were fed. Gooden says a couple things drove SEC's decision-making process. Most obvious was keeping politics out of it.
Yeah, we stuck with the science.
This is also far from the first disease Native American communities have had to contend with.
Obviously, with history of pandemics going through reservations, for generations, and a lot of the hardships they've had with that, the tribe had a special nervousness, about the pandemic affecting their community.
While the goal was to protect the community as a whole, there was special consideration for tribal elders. Both Sacaga and Chippewa community and Lakvita Zaire took extra care of elders, like making grocery deliveries and prioritizing vaccines for them.
The elders of the community, they're like the database, of the community. They hold all the tribe's information, all of their traditions, their culture, all their history, everything.
Despite all their best efforts, SCC had 4 tribal members die from COVID, including some elders.
When they lose an elder, it's like they're losing a part of their history.
While they mourn those losses, SCC is looking forward. Both tribal communities are focused on vaccinations. Many of their tribal members have already been able to get vaccinated. And just like throughout the pandemic, the tribes are making sure everyone in their communities are taken care of.
We've had to change the way we live. We've had to not visit people that we love. We've had to, make personal choices to live a different lifestyle. And so I think with the light at the end of the tunnel, after people are vaccinated, to go back to some sort of normalcy is encouraging folks to become vaccinated.
The SCC Health Clinic has vaccine available by appointment for tribal members, staff, and those who live in Mole Lake. Lakvita Zaire Health Clinic is planning a couple mass vaccination clinics this month that will be open to the general public.
A year ago, few could have predicted exactly how the COVID-19 pandemic would impact the Northwoods. One surprise result? It's been a catalyst for many families to move here. They're leaving behind urban living, working remotely, and enrolling their children in local schools. Ben Meyer introduces us to a few of those families.
And then I'll do this.
Katie Martins looks into her computer camera and greets her virtual audience, starting a session of yoga with essential oils.
Couple of deeper breaths as you feel yourself.
She's in her backyard in Saner, surrounded by a forest of changing color.
Breath by breath.
Most of her audience is where Martins lived just 6 months ago, the greater Milwaukee area. She and her family moved to Vilas County, and her students stayed with her virtually.
So it's just like, I can do this from anywhere. Saner's awesome. It's our family house, and it's better for the kids. So it was kind of a no-brainer then at that point.
Her great-grandfather built the home in the woods in 1925, and it's been in the family ever since.
So there's a lot of memories here. There's a lot of great memories, and it was always a vacation place, but now it's home.
As the COVID-19 pandemic hit Wisconsin in March, Martins and her husband, Will, decided to escape the Milwaukee suburbs, come north, and go all in on Katie's natural healing and yoga business, Wellness Compass.
Coronavirus was sort of like that catalyst that was just like, we're doing this. We're gonna do this. So inhale the aroma for 4 counts.
The home is blessed with good broadband, a necessity for the business. Will lugs a modem and router outside the house for every class, and Katie teaches remote classes from her Northwoods haven.
Yes, they're in the city, but if they can see that, and they've even commented they hear the birds.
Oh, we had
The couple has a fifth grader, Ellie, and a first grader, Carlo. They gave up residence in a top-rated suburban district and enrolled them at Northland Pines this fall.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye, buddy.
Bye.
See you at the pickup.
At first, Katie was hesitant about the quality of rural schools, but Will says Northland Pines won them over.
I mean, thank goodness the schools are really good up here, and that's something that, you know, maybe a lot of people south of here might not understand, but they're really good and the kids are doing well.
It's a pitch Northland Pines Superintendent Scott Foster has been successfully making a lot lately.
I think they're just really surprised that you can have all this and still live in God's country, I guess, as you would say.
Every door you walk in, you know, we have every kid hand sanitizer in and out.
More Northland Pines families than usual chose a virtual learning option for this COVID-impacted school year, but the majority still wanted their children to come in person.
Providence is the capital of Rhode Island.
Foster says the district has about 60 new students this year, at least half from families like the Martins, seasonal residents who decided to stay north because of the pandemic. Many rely on improving broadband to work remotely.
It just became real. I think the world of work has changed, so some of these families now are able to work from up here, and that was a huge game changer.
And we have a path to the lake, too, on the backside of our house.
That's true for the Bowl family, whose house is between Phelps and Land O'Lakes. Laura Bowl's husband works for a Chicago-based Fortune 500 company, doing it remotely from the Northwoods during the pandemic. Without broadband, the family wouldn't be here.
Without internet?
Without,
no way.
At least high speed.
No way.
Yeah.
No way.
The Bowles lived in the Chicago suburbs, and the pandemic shut down their normal life this spring.
The whole park district closed. Every class closed. Ballet canceled. All our playgroups canceled. The mom's group at church we went to every week. Everything shut down.
They sought refuge at their vacation home on Kildare Lake in March.
We came up here like the week that happened, thinking like maybe we'll be here for a couple weeks to a couple months.
So that was his vacation house.
But spring bled into summer, the virus didn't subside, and the Bowles let the lease on their Chicago rental home expire, embracing the Northwoods as their new home.
How was school today?
Laura enrolled her elementary schoolers, Abby and Steven, at Land O'Lakes Elementary in the Northland Pines District. She loves that there are only 45 students in the entire school.
It's such an ideal school situation because the school's so small. It's not like the elementary schools in Chicago suburbs where there's like 5 kindergarten classes and like 600 kids.
If Laura's husband can keep working remotely into the future, the Bowles want to leave Chicago behind and make this home for good.
That's a serious possibility,
definitely,
right?
A serious possibility, yeah.
For now, the kids are getting accustomed to a new school and a new life in the Northwoods. It's a shift just like the one the pandemic has accelerated for so many families.
They'll make friends, they'll adjust, they'll, all of us, I guess, are.
Yeah.
So. You got a sticker? Was that for finishing your homework?
Yeah.
Good job.
Can you remember the last time you attended a live performance? There's a chance it's been a while, likely since before COVID-19 struck Wisconsin. The virus has put the performing arts industry in peril, spelling hardship for theaters, performers, and art educators everywhere. But here in the Northwoods, the show must go on. Aaron Gottsacker has more on how local theaters are adapting to the times.
I'm sitting in Rhinelander High School's nearly empty auditorium. On the stage in front of me, about 20 students are performing their final dress rehearsal of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. One of the actors twirls around in a long, rainbow-colored coat. They're singing into microphones tucked beneath tie-dye masks.
La, 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 la.
The students are getting ready for a weekend of performances. And like their rehearsals, these performances will look much different than shows from a pre-COVID era. Kristen Higgins is one of the directors. In addition to the masks, she says the play has been choreographed so that students stay 6 feet apart.
I'm constantly yelling, "Watch your distance!"
The play is short, only about an hour, so it doesn't have an intermission when the audience can mingle. Not that the auditorium will seat a full house. The majority of its 700 seats are blocked off with masking tape. The musical's other director, Roddy McMillan, points to the taped-off rows.
We've got like 2 seats on a row, and then you see there's like a row which is empty.
Each student can invite 2 guests. That's what the open seats are for. Everyone else will have to live stream the performance. But despite these COVID-induced adjustments, the School District of Rhinelander's drama department is doing more than many theaters in the North Woods. Most have canceled their seasons entirely. Many have yet to decide when they'll reopen. Theater North in Ironwood, Michigan is an example.
This would have been their 57th season, and they have never gone dark before from live performances.
That's Miles Mikkonen. Mikkonen spent his childhood performing on Theater North's stage. From there, he went on to study at Juilliard. Last March, he was preparing to perform an opera in Switzerland. Then COVID struck, and he suddenly found himself back home in the UP.
When I got back from Switzerland, it was definitely a few weeks or a month of like deep mourning and depression just for my own personal career and understanding what was happening in the world and the prospect for all professional musicians, artists, performers.
A month later, Mikkonen started working with the theater's president and co-president to figure out alternatives to live performances. Their solution? Spotlight videos. They rehearsed 20-minute skits with community actors.
And then we filmed all of them, socially distant.
The final products were posted to Facebook, where anyone could view them at no cost. These spotlight videos were pretty popular.
Our first scene in the first weekend had hit over 10,000 views.
And with views came donations.
We started getting donations from Florida, from California, Maine, even places in Canada.
Now, Mikkonen is working with the Theater North Board of Directors to plan an outdoor, socially distanced arts festival in August. It'll feature singers from Broadway and the Metropolitan Opera, art exhibits, and an international film festival. Like the spotlight videos, fundraising efforts for this project were announced through Facebook videos, like this.
I'm just so excited. So in the first 24 hours, we have raised $5,000, and it's just the beginning, but oh my gosh, what an opening number.
Since then, Theater North has raised over $10,000 for the project. Other arts organizations haven't been as fortunate. Like Theater North, the Campanile Center for the Arts is also relying heavily on donations at a time when they normally wouldn't have to. Sandy Madden is the center's executive director.
Has the Center for the Arts taken a financial hit at all? Has this hurt?
Oh, yeah.
She says when COVID first hit, the Campanile Center canceled everything for months. No performances, music lessons, or art classes. Now it's offering music lessons again, but Madden says that income is only enough to fund the teachers.
We don't make a lot of extra through the music lessons.
Without revenue coming from performances or leasing out their venue, Madden says the center is operating at a fraction of its capacity. She's received grants from the state, but she's trying to be especially economical. Before COVID, Madden ordered new lighting and sound equipment.
I halted that order. Mm-hmm. Just because I didn't know when we would be able to, open up to utilize the equipment again. And quite frankly, I wanted to preserve the cash.
Madden says the Campanile Center for the Arts will survive the pandemic.
But The question is just going to be, what will the Campanile look like on the other side?
Back in Rhinelander High School's auditorium, the cast of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat are rehearsing their final bows. For some of the students on the stage, play practice was a sought-after semblance of normalcy in a world disrupted by a global pandemic. Arts organizations are still figuring out how to survive in this world. But no matter what happens next, COVID-19 will be a tough act to follow.
The vaccination effort happening in Wisconsin and across the U.S. is key to ending the COVID-19 pandemic. Katie Thorson spoke with a medical expert about where things currently stand with the vaccines available and what's ahead.
With the recent approval of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine, the U.S. has now approved 3 vaccines in the fight against the coronavirus. I'm joined by Dr. William Hartman. He is with the Department of Anesthesiology at UW Health, and he's the principal investigator for the UW-AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine trial. Can you talk to me a little bit about the difference between the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the other two that we already have approved in the U.S.?
The Johnson & Johnson is actually an adenovirus vaccine, so a more traditional platform that allows it to be stored much more easily. So it can be stored in just a regular refrigerator, like a hotel refrigerator, and remain stable for many, many months. And it's a lot less expensive to produce than the mRNA vaccines. And so there's certain advantages just to the logistical nature of having an adenovirus vaccine in the mix now.
And, you know, we've read a lot about the efficacy of these different vaccines. The mRNA ones seem to have a higher one, whereas this Johnson & Johnson one has a lower one. But what does that really mean for either the effectiveness of these vaccines or, you know, kind of the real-world applications of them in terms of fighting off the virus?
Both of the mRNA vaccines have an effectiveness of 94% or higher, meaning that there's a very low chance that a person is going to develop symptomatic COVID when they've had one of those vaccines. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has, in the United States, an effectiveness somewhere around 72 to 75%. And so there's a slightly higher chance of developing symptomatic COVID with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on board, but it's still the effectiveness is still significantly higher than something like the flu shot. All of these vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson, are all extremely effective against preventing hospitalization, severe disease, and death from COVID-19. Nobody who's received any of the vaccines has died from COVID-19 at this point.
What more research is being done, or what more answers are we going to get about those vaccines that have gone through this process and gotten that emergency use authorization?
So the biggest missing piece of evidence, if you will, is how long does the immunity last? And so, you know, these vaccines have only been out for a couple of months at this point. And so we don't know how long that immunity is. Is it a year? Is it 2 years? And so each of these trials is designed to follow participants for 2 years so that we can find how long those antibodies stay in their system. So that's the biggest piece of evidence that's still missing at this point. But in a pandemic time, under emergency use, we know that they're safe. We know that they're effective. And it's our job to get them out to the public so we can protect as many people as we can.
I think a lot of people have it in their head that, you know, the vaccine is going to be the key to ending the pandemic. Is that an accurate outlook?
I think so. As long as we can stay ahead of the variants, meaning we vaccinate people before these variant forms can spread to them and cause problems, I absolutely think we can end this pandemic, put it in the rearview mirror. But the goal and the desire is to really get as many people vaccinated as possible so that you fight fire with fire. You know, we can attack that virus so that it stops attacking everybody else.
Are you able to see, you know, if we continue at this rate or if we keep getting, you know, increases like we have been of the amount of vaccine, are you able to see a timeline for how and when this could end?
I still think that by the end of summer, anyway, that we'll be in a position where this virus is really under control and the pandemic, well, we'll still have to keep an eye on things, but for all intents and purposes, I would think should come to an end. That would be the hope. We're doing everything we can to get the vaccine from the vaccine makers into people's arms, and the states are doing a tremendous job.
Thank you, Dr. William Hartman with UW Health. Dr. Hartman also encourages anyone who is hesitant about getting the COVID-19 vaccine to speak with a medical professional and get your questions answered.
While there may be an end in sight for the COVID-19 pandemic, there's still a need to be cautious. Medical experts urge people not to lax on COVID-19 safety measures like wearing a mask and practicing social distancing, even after you get the vaccine.
No matter what happens, WXPR will continue to keep you informed. You can stay connected online at WXPR.org and follow us on social media.
And we'll keep bringing you stories on air about COVID-19, vaccination efforts, and the impact on life in the Northwoods. Thanks for joining us for this WXPR special report.